is the second of a drop-in series on the White Lotus Sutra. So that is a text from Mahayana Buddhism, which is the second great phase of Buddhism. So what I'm going to do is just say a little bit about, well, a little bit by way of recap on what is the White Lotus Sutra, and then I'll launch into tonight. So I wanted to start with a little favourite quote, which I'm sure I've said here before because I like it very much. It's from a scientist called Haldane. I don't know anything about him apart from he said this quote. And what he said was, "The universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it's queerer than we can suppose." So I really, really like that. It sort of somehow sparks my imagination. And I was thinking, you could say that for a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, the universe is not only more inconceivable than we suppose, it's more inconceivable than we can suppose. In other words, as Bhante Sangharakshita himself says, we really don't know anything about anything at all. Yeah, so Sangharakshita, for those of you who don't know, is the founder of the Tri Ratna movement and our teacher, for those of us in the order. So he says, we really don't know anything about anything at all. It's not just that we know a little bit about something, or we partially know about things. We really don't know anything. Everything is inconceivable. So, you know, you can take anything like these flowers on the shrine. We might think we know what they are, but actually we don't really know what they are at all. Or a human being, even more, like, you know, a human being is inconceivable, really, aren't they? Human beings conceivable, inconceivable. And if even ordinary flowers and human beings are inconceivable, then notions like enlightenment are just, yeah, they're just inconceivable. So that kind of leaves us with possibly a problem. Like, if even enlightenment is inconceivable, if even a Buddha, what am I trying to say? How can we talk about it? That's what I'm trying to say. How can we talk about something that's inconceivable? Yeah, if the Buddha sees existence as inconceivable and inexpressible, how are we going to talk about it? So one of the ways that that Buddhism is expressed is through stories, through myths and parables. Because concepts just can't do it. Even, like, I'm not enlightened, so I can't talk about Buddhism and concepts, but even if I was, I still couldn't, because it's something that goes beyond expression in that way. So one of the ways that Buddhism is expressed is through stories, and that's what the White Lotus Sutra does. The White Lotus Sutra is a collection, really, of different myths and similes and parables. And how it came about is itself a story. What we heard last week is the White Lotus Sutra was preached, if that's the right way to talk about it, on top, by the Buddha, on top of Vulture's Peak. So Vulture's Peak is a real place, as we heard, but in the context of the sutra, it's more of a mythical place. So it's the highest pinnacle of the world, not literally, but for the sort of purposes of for the purposes of the mythical expression. It's the highest you can get in the world before you're in heaven, as it were. So the White Lotus Sutra is preached by the Buddha from there. And it's preached to an audience of thousands and thousands of beings. Human beings, but not just human beings. All sorts of mythological creatures. and some ordinary human beings, and some very, very highly practiced human beings as well. So as soon as you're sort of talking about this Vulture's Peak as the highest point of the world, and as soon as you're talking about these thousands and thousands of beings and non-human beings, you know that you're in the realm of myth and symbol. You know you're not in the literal world. But it's sort of no less true for that. Yeah, it's no less true for that. So what you get right at the beginning is the Buddha saying, well, this whole notion of like enlightenment goes beyond what any of you understand. Right? It goes beyond what any of you understand. So probably there was a mixture of responses to that. Probably some people felt quite excited by that. I feel quite excited when I hear a notion like that. But we know that for at least 5,000 of the beings, they weren't excited to hear this. They were sort of disgusted, really, and appalled at the notion that enlightenment was beyond what they understood, because they thought they did understand it, and they walked out. Yeah, so those, the first thing that happens is 5,000 people just walk straight out. Because they just don't want to hear this. They don't want to hear that there's anything they don't know. It doesn't excite them. And so I think before, in a way, anything even starts, you've got, well, quite an important teaching there about, well, how do we respond to when we're confronted with, well, we don't know everything. And I can't resist telling a little story that happened to me just the other day. Just last week, I had the good fortune to be in Madrid on my holidays. And I was in the art gallery looking at the El Greco paintings, which was a very wonderful experience. And there was this set of four paintings that weren't by El Greco himself. They were from his school. So there were four of his students had painted these paintings. And there was very, very good commentary on all the pictures. It was really great looking at them. And the person who'd written the little blurb, he said, look at these paintings. He said, they're from the four students. And he said, look at the robes on this one. Like, you know, the guy's trying to do what El Greco did, but, like, it's rubbish, really. Like, he hasn't managed it. Like, it's just, yeah, it's obviously, like, rubbish. He didn't actually say rubbish, but he said, like, no, you know, he hasn't managed it. He hasn't managed to pull it off. He's tried to copy El Greco, he hasn't managed it. And then he said, but look at the robes on this one. This student, like, has done it really well. Look at these, like, they're brilliant. It's just like El Greco. And I was looking at the two of these and I was thinking, I can't see any difference. Like, literally, I was looking, and I sort of tried to, I think, oh yeah, I think I do see, but actually, I couldn't really see. If the truth to be told, I couldn't see the difference between these. To me, they look the same, and I just thought, actually, I feel like I could talk the whole night about just that, actually, because that's really interesting, isn't it? I couldn't see the difference, but I believed the person who'd written the thing that there was a difference. And what I conclude, you know, I'm not an artist. I haven't got that amount of sensitivity that can yet tell the difference. I imagine if I kept looking at paintings, and maybe one would even have to become a painter to be able to see the difference. That there is a difference, but I couldn't see it. I was talking to my friend about this, who's a musician, Vishvantra, some of you know, and she said, oh yeah, it's just the same with music. She said you could have the same piece of music played by two people. She said one, it would be a world-class interpretation, and the other, it would just be quite ordinary. She said most people will not be able to tell the difference between that. It would just sound the same to you. So, I mean, maybe we've all probably got something like that in our lives that we're a little bit expert in. I don't know, it might be like the taste of two different kinds of food. Actually, I live with someone in the community and she can taste, She says, oh yeah, that's a really cheap version, and that's, you know, da-da. And again, to me, I can't distinguish, you know. I haven't got that amount of refinement. But and so the sort of point I'm labouring is that we don't know everything. There is further to go, even when we think we do. Even when I think, if you'd ask me, are those robes, you know, as a matter of fact, I didn't even realise they were the students. You know, to me, I thought, well, this is probably El Greco himself. You know, I couldn't tell. There'll be lots of things like that we can't tell. So we have to trust a sort of higher, I don't know if authority is quite the right word, but something like that. We have to trust that there is somebody who can see more and who can discriminate more than we can. Or not. Or we can just walk out. You know, we can just go, it looks the same to me. What's the big deal? You know, or we can think, oh God, I could find out more about this. Yeah. So I think there's a lot in that, just the fact that these first 5,000 leave. And apparently the Buddha says when they leave, and now the assembly is purified. So I think that's quite an interesting thing he says. After they've left, he says, now the assembly is purified. I just wondered if I could throw that out and see, what do you think the Buddha meant by saying, now the assembly is purified? What do you think he was saying about the people who were left? The people of doubt have gone, yeah. So that's, yeah, so yeah, the people of doubt have gone. And what do you think? So the people that are left.
Well, it's. I don't quite know.
Yeah. What do you think's kept them? What do you think's stopped them from living?
Well, it's fragile, isn't it?
I think it's something akin to that. I think at the very least it's receptivity.
Right.
So they might not totally, they don't know what the Buddha's going to say, but they're open to hearing it. Yeah, they're open. So I think it is on the way to Shraddha. So Shraddha, for those of you who haven't heard that word, it's the word we use for faith in Buddhism, but it's not a blind faith. But it's a sort of, at least so far, it's an openness to thinking, and maybe even an excitement, oh, what's a Buddha going to say, you know, that we don't yet know. Yeah, so it's, yeah, so that's what he means by the sin is purified. Yes, the people that have just kind of thought, I know it all, have gone. The people with a sort of willful doubt. There's a sort of healthy doubt, isn't there? There's sort of healthy not believing things just totally on trust. But there's a sort of willful, oh, I'm not going to listen. I know it all. I'm not going to listen to anything. They've gone, so the assembly's now purified because who's left is receptive. Yeah. Okay, so that's who's left. So a lot in that. So you've got then all the remaining people are receptive to what the Buddha has to say. And what the Buddha does say, as I said, is a sort of a series of parables. And stories, the Buddha, yeah, it's all the whole rest of the sutra is recounted in stories. Some of them quite a little bit complex and some of them quite simple. The one that we're exploring tonight is very, very simple. It hardly even is a parable in a way, it's more like a symbol. And it's the parable or the symbol of the rain cloud. And that's what I was reading to you. It's a very, very kind of simple thing. So you've just got this image of the rains coming, which of course in India are more welcome than they are here. We often don't like the rain as such, but after all the dry season in India, the rain is like a miracle. So it's a bit like, it's a good time to be doing this because it's a little bit like the coming of spring, where we kind of, you know, it's just really lovely, isn't it, at the moment, just seeing all these shoots and, you know, blossoms and everything coming. So yeah, I've never been in India at this time, but I think it just all happens, but really speeded up. The rain all comes down and things just start like shooting up before your eyes. So you've got this symbol of the, after this long, long period of drought, the rains come So it's very, very joyous. It must seem like a miracle. The rains come. So you've got this one huge rain cloud, and the rain's all falling on everything, and everything's growing, and it's all growing in its own way. So that's the sort of point, that you've got the rain cloud, the same rain, but as it falls, everything's growing as it should grow, as it were. So like trees are growing into trees, herbs are growing into herbs. You know, some plants obviously are really tall, some like creep along the ground, some are really tiny and delicate. Some are really kind of, you know, huge and monstrous. But they're all grown and they're all nourished by the same rain. And the Buddha's saying, well, that's like the appearance of a Buddha. You know, the Buddha appears, like showers the Dharma, showers down the teaching on beings. They all receive this nourishment. I mean, it's lovely. It's a lovely kind of metaphor, really. This whole imagery of growth and this whole imagery of the Dharma as something that nourishes. But each grows in its same, in its own way, in its individual way. So that's what I want to explore. I just want to explore that a bit more this evening. I'm going to be using two different texts, both from Bhante. So a little bit from this, The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment, which is Bhante's commentary on the sutra. And then I'm going to look at what is the Sangha, which is another work by Bhante. So both of these are in the bookshop, highly recommended. So everything's growing according to its own nature. So people, you know, might all be hearing the same teaching, following the same path, but what they can respond to it in very, very different ways. So you see that in the spiritual community. So some people might spend much more time meditating, on retreats for very long times indeed. A friend of ours is just about 6 months ago embarked on a year-long solitary retreat. So she spent a whole year like meditating in solitude. Other people, that wouldn't be their cup of tea at all. You know, they might think it was much more of an expression of the Dharma to work in the world, to sort of alleviate suffering in that way. Some people might, their expression might be through the arts, through poetry or music or so on, all different ways. So it's the same Dharma, but it's expressed in different ways. And Bhante then says this lovely thing. He says, and others again, perhaps the majority, he says, and just go on being themselves. So he says they don't display any specific talent. I really like that, because he's saying, well, you don't have to be sort of particularly wonderful at anything. He says all you have to do is become more and more individual. And I'm going to sort of explore what he means by becoming more and more individual in a minute, because he's got quite a lot to say about that. But first of all, what he says is this paradox. He says the paradox is that although we become more and more different from each other, at the same time we become more and more like each other. So we become like each other in that we become hopefully more mindful, more metaful, more sensitive. But we become much more different from each other in this way that the plants become more and more themselves. And he's got a lovely, to sort of change the metaphor from plants, he's got this lovely image. He said it's like you've got this whole series of lights and they've all got different lampshades, and the lampshades have all got these sort of patterns sort of drawn on them. And so as you practice, it's like the light gets turned up brighter and brighter. So as you look at each person, you not only see the light getting brighter, but you see the pattern of the lampshade more and more distinctly. So both things are happening at once. Both the light's getting brighter and the pattern's getting more and more distinct. And when he's talking about this, he says, oh yeah, you see that. He's asking us, don't you see that as people practice, both those things happen. I really like that as well because, it also allows for difference very strongly. Like you might not even like some of the patterns of the lampshades, but you can still recognise the brightness of the light inside, which is good, isn't it? So, you don't have to quite sort of take to everybody. And again, everybody doesn't have to be the same. So I think this is the crucial thing he's bringing out here. He says that in the spiritual life and the Dharma life, there isn't any question of regimentation. He says it's reasonable to expect that if they put the effort in, if we put the effort in, we will grow. All human beings will grow. That's kind of natural to expect. He says, but it's unreasonable to expect all human beings to grow in the same way. And he says, watch out, because it's easy to forget that, especially when we discover something ourselves that is helpful to growth and development. You're dying to just go and sort of, you almost want to foist that on everyone if you're not careful, don't you? Sometimes that happens when we learn to meditate. At first, we're kind of like almost kind of trying to get all our friends to sort of do it. We can't sort of foist things. We can't foist growth onto other people. And the other thing can happen as well. If we discover something that's not helpful, we can refuse to recognise that it's helpful to other people. So that's just something to be careful of. So it's a nice little way to remember, isn't it, that it's reasonable to expect that with effort we'll all grow and develop, but it's unreasonable to think that it'll be in the same way for everyone. So maybe I'll just pause there for a moment. Does that sort of resonate so far? And just a little kind of, there's a little health warning there just to be careful that we don't sort of foist our way, even within the Dharma life, we don't foist our way onto other people necessarily. It means we've got to be quite sensitive to other people, really listen to them and see what they need at any particular time. Okay, so I'm going to swap text now, because this whole thing about whether you think in terms of these plants all growing in their own way, or these lampshades, kind of their own patterns kind of becoming more and more distinct, it reminded me very, very strongly of a whole teaching of Bhante's, which, he, as with a lot of Bhante, he's drawing from the tradition, but he's putting it in terms that aren't, the terms he uses aren't necessarily traditional, although the whole teaching is drawn very much from the Buddhist tradition. It's like he's giving us new ways to think about things. The whole set of teachings that reminded me very much on is what Bhante has to say about the individual, or he calls it the true individual, and he gives it a sort of capital T, capital I. And he opposes the true individual from what he calls a group member. Yeah, so these terms need unpacking, because Bhante uses them in very particular ways, and he talks about it quite a lot, as I say, in this text, what is the Sangha? I was reading it this morning, I thought, God, it's a bit provocative, all this. So prepare to be provoked. You might be provoked. Don't walk out like the 5,000. Prepare to be provoked. It's a good thing. Certainly I was a bit provoked. You might not be provoked, but you might be. But if you do, stay with it. So this is Bhante teaching on the group, the true individual, and the spiritual community, which are all distinct. So So the very first thing he says individuals are in short supply. So immediately, you know, he's got the individual for Bhante is something quite is quite lofty. He's saying, don't think you're an individual just because you're sort of statistically one in a way. It's quite elevated the way he talks about an individual. He says individuals are in short supply. He says when individuals come together, they make up between them a spiritual community. So again, this is what he's very clear on, this definition that what we call the spiritual community is made up of individuals and only that. Yeah, only that. He says when non-individuals come together, what you have is a group. So he's given individual as the capital I. I don't really know what to give group. I don't want to give it a capital G because it kind of elevates it. But he's definitely using a group in a very particular way, quite pejorative way, really, here. So when non-individuals come together, you've got a group. And he says this is what we want to explore. They're definitely distinct. The group and the spiritual community are distinct, even opposing things. Well, maybe not opposing, because later on he says there's connection between them, but distinct, yeah. So basically a group is a collection of people who are not individuals, yeah. So what he tries to get us to do, first of all, is, well, in a sense, see where we are not individuals, even though we're statistically individuals. Where are we not individuals? And he says, if you look carefully and honestly enough about where our opinions come from, where our decisions come from, he says, we'll see that only too often we don't have minds of our own. He says, what we think and feel is determined, well, first of all, very much by our conditioning, by the particular circumstances of our own particular existence. And he says, this is one of the first provocative things. He says, if we're self-conscious at all, it's only in the most vague and intermittent way. He says that we tend to think and feel and act according to how others are thinking, feeling and acting. And he says, we're very quick to accept the norms and values to where we're surrounded, to the various groups with which we belong. So he says most of the time we're failing to act as individuals. We're just picking up the norms of the groups we belong. What are these groups? Well, the groups are, we're born into groups, like our sort of family group is our kind of first group, and then we join other groups, yeah? A bit more consciously, yeah. And he says the groups that we're born into are even more group-like than the ones we join. So the ones we join, there's a bit of sort of consciousness to, but the ones we're born into, like our family group, our kind of possibly religious group, our cultural group, we're born into, and very often we just unconsciously accept the values of that. We don't really even know we're doing that. We often only know it when we encounter like someone else from another group who acts in a quite different way, and we're often a bit shocked, because most of it is unconscious. And then some groups we then later join, which is a bit more conscious, but we can, Bhante's saying we're still not completely conscious. We gravitate. We'll often just gravitate towards people that are a bit like us, that believe in the same things, and so on. So we join various groups, political parties, like teams. We do it sort of for support, don't we? It's a sort of herd instinct. It's not like totally negative. Because we get protection from the group, we get support from the group, we get sort of reflection back from the group, we can sort of feel ourselves in the group. But what's the what's the problems are that it's often unconscious, and that the way we accept the norms of the group is often unconscious. So I'll say just a little bit more about it. So what do I want to say? Well, basically, the trouble with being in these groups, if it's unconscious, is what happens if we try and assert our individuality. It's so the group will not want us to do that. Yeah, the group always tends, the group and the way Bantu's using it always tends to discourage us asserting our own individuality. The group, in this definition of the group, needs us to conform. It needs us to conform. It's kind of a power structure. There's people in the group, or the group itself wield the power, and there's us, the members of the group, who give it to them. And those, you know, might swap around, but there's always going to be the power of the group, and then ourselves kind of giving our power away to the group. So we're going to be frightened, either, you know, it might be quite subtle, that fear, to do anything that means we might be rejected from the group. That's where the problem comes. The group's going to be accepting of us as long as we toe the line of the group. As soon as we kind of go, actually, I'm not into that, we're at risk of being rejected from the group. So that whole dynamic will tend to keep us conforming, because we tend to, that kind of need for acceptance is very, very strong with most people, yeah? So we're kind of locked into it, yeah? So maybe I'll just pause there, because that's certainly what's been put forward about the group in this way, but I want to see if that sounds, first of all, familiar to people. Does that ring true? Do you sort of see what he's getting at with this group thing? So what we're saying about it is it's something we do out of a sort of desire to belong. There could be something sort of healthy in a kind of almost like the animal part of our nature that wants to herd together in it, you know, it's the sort of the survival of the species. It's got that going for it. But there's also something that's not healthy in it, because it's going to prevent us from growing. Is there anything to be said about that? Anything you relate to, agree with, disagree with? Or no? Yes,
Philippe. Certainly experienced it. Just on a very basic level,
with alcohol. Ah, okay, yes. Sorry,
yeah.
I'm a little bit hard of hearing, I think, these days.
It's a very simple level with alcohol, if you're out with a group of friends, choose not to drink. There can be a lot of peer pressure. If you feel, if you just, I'll have a water, as if somehow you're judging them.
Yeah.
It's there can be that sort of, the group sort of, I've also been thinking of becoming vegetarian, and similarly people feel it's an attack on them.
Yeah, so I think that's true. I think, you know, you said they're basic examples, but I think they're really good examples. So you said the example, first of all, of alcohol. So would drinking with friends be something that sort of used to be something you'd do more, but you're wanting to move away from? Or
Yeah.
So I think that's quite a good example, isn't it? Because it's as long as you're kind of doing the same as everyone else, then everything's fine. But as soon as you kind of say, I want to do something else, people seem to feel threatened. They don't really want, you've upset the status quo, haven't you? Yeah, and same with something like vegetarianism. yeah, you're wanting to do something for your growth and development, but it's not going to sit that well. So the good examples, yes.
Surely you can still be an improvement and have some individuality as well.
Okay, so say more.
Well, I find it very difficult to be in a group where everyone did just the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Belief, fair enough. But people have individuality. You know, I belong to a chapter, as you do as well. But there's individuality amongst the members of that chapter.
So maybe I just define these terms. So a chapter is a group of, a collection of order members. So I think Banty's using the word group, not just as a, he's using it in a particular way. So he's using it in a way, he's defining it as a collection of people who are consciously or unconsciously trying to get everyone within it to stay the same, yeah? Do you see what I mean?
I do, but you may well stay the same to a certain extent, but do it in your own way. That's what I meant by the individuality of it. You know, we're not all in Russia where we're all being told what we must think, or in China where we've been told exactly what we must think and we can't err away from it.
So though we're not, I still wonder whether we're as safe from that as we think. That's why I kind of thought Philippe's example was quite interesting. When you try and step beyond something, we can be held back from it. But I think what you're talking about is you're going on to something different, which is a spiritual community, which I'm going to come on to. Yeah, so I think that distinction you're saying is right, but maybe just a little step ahead of what I'm exploring just now. Yeah. So I've got three hands up. So Kate, and then Matt, and then yourself. Yeah.
I just wanted to say I've experienced this myself, and I have a feeling that that's what people tend to do. Like generally, they form groups.
They form groups. Yeah.
It doesn't matter where, but that's what they do in every aspect of life.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, and I'm more thinking about the non-group or spiritual community.
Uh-huh.
And what is your own experience with that? Because I would think that even at the beginning, of the if you go there. Is this idea and understanding of this, I would say it's natural tendency for people to somehow converge to the group thing behavior, even if you try not to. I'm very interested what happens when you start having different experiences. How can this be evolved or cultivated?
So maybe I'll just say, just in case everyone didn't hear what you were saying, so you were saying that you'd be interested in hearing more about what a spiritual community, which is a collection of individuals, is, and highlighting the tendency to revert back to the group. So I think that's really interesting what you're saying, because I think that is, in my experience, true, that the gravitational pull to revert back to the group is strong. And I think that's because one of the reasons that is strong is because our need, even our desperate need for sort of approval, acceptance, is strong. So I think we'll always, it requires a lot of self-awareness and courage to be free from that pull towards simply wanting acceptance and approval. As long as that drives us, the gravitational pull to the group will be very, very strong. Yeah. So I'll come on to that a little bit more in a minute. So I'll just stay with, just for a minute, just hearing if people relate to this experience of groups, sort of that we almost unconsciously belong to and that tendency. So Kate, were you going to say something about that?
I mean, I really relate to the idea of groups that exert this kind of pressure to... I feel it most when I feel it's clashing with my values.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So, like, at university, I felt like the general ethos really clashed with my values, and I found it really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I also... I guess I don't see such a, like, clear line between kind of enlightened or spiritual communities and other groups.
Uh-huh.
Because I guess, so I just want to say something for groups in a way, because... I'm in two groups outside of, like, Buddhism that are really enriching and that I can think of, and one of them is a political group that I have joined because of explicit values that me and all the people share.
Yeah.
So maybe there are norms, but it's really productive because I guess I fit with it.
Uh-huh.
It is supportive, and differences outside of that explicit thing that we've all come together to do are really celebrated, so it's quite an enlightened group. And then I was also just thinking about the fact that groups themselves can develop. So, like, I have a very close group of friends from school, and Meg, when we were 16, it was much more, everyone had to be the same, but now the group has evolved.
I think that's quite good to bring out, that there's sort of gradations, So I think it's interesting what you said about your political group. Something can be very, very positive. And I think it's good to be aware that that is conditional, though. It's conditioned by you sort of sharing those beliefs. So I think the thing would be to... How to phrase this? So I think the thing to watch would be that you're still able to be free in your mind. You know, sometimes when you're part of a group like that and you get a little glimmer of I'm not sure I totally believe this, but then you go, oh my God, and you sort of squash it down because you know that that could be the end of everything. So I think that's the thing to watch for. If you're a group would be more or less positive, the more it would allow that to, a group would start to move more towards what was a truly spiritual community, the more it really allowed that to flower, even for somebody to start actually realising that they might believe something that was opposed to them. To the group. But Bhante also talks about the positive group, which is something supportive, So you might not go straight from... I mean, the very sort of extreme of the negative group would be it was really, sort of almost forcing you to conform, And then you can move from that to a more... to something more positive, that was supportive, like a group of friends or so on, So just, but I think that's quite interesting with things like politics, and because I think you can, as long as you recognise that it is conditional, and then it is. Well, we all need that, there is a sort of human need to have, to share things with people. What were you going to say, Matt?
I have also, probably my sister, have had experiences of this, but I've just noticed it manifest in kind of almost the opposite way at times.
Okay,
where,
good.
People react to the group situation fearing they're going to fall out of the group or not be accepted in it by kind of rebelling in a way.
I
think that's something Sangharakshita talks about. Deliberately being obstructive disagreeing. And that can be quite hard to distinguish from kind of genuine individuality. I think that's a problem I have with this kind of teaching as well. I often feel like I can't tell, either in myself or in other people, whether I'm being individual or whether I'm just reacting because I feel uncomfortable in the group.
No, that's really good you brought that out, and I was going to come on to that. So what Bhante talks about these things, as you've said. So he says you've got, I was going to do this on the flip chart, but I'll just do it kind of with hand gestures. So he says you've got somebody who's just, if you're a group, if you're just kind of blindly sort of subsumed by the group, to the extent you're that, you're conforming, yeah? So we've all probably got tendencies to conform, even though we don't like to admit it. But he says also there's the tendency to rebel. He calls it being an individualist rather than a true individual. And he said that they're like equal and opposite. Often we just ricochet between them. And it's like they're just on a kind of level, yeah? So you've got because they're both in reaction to the group. Either you're getting pulled into it, or you're kind of going, oh, you know, stuff you lot, I'm going to just rebel. But you still need the group, because you couldn't, if you didn't have a group, you'd have nothing to rebel against. So in a funny sort of way, it's just the same thing as conforming. It's just the other side of it. And it's like he would place the true individual not like halfway in between, but over and above the two of them. So something with a higher perspective. But yeah, I think that's a very good question. How do you tell if you're being a true individual or if you're just being a rebel, if you're just being an individualist?
Sometimes you can kind of find yourself in some kind of conflict and you don't know whether or not you don't know how far to assert your conflict.
Yeah.
It might just be you're reacting.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have anything to say.
Well, I was wondering if you've also, what have you learned? How do you tell yourself? Have you had any experiences of telling?
I guess I try and look and see if I'm, you know, if I'm angry. Or kind of stressed out or defensive.
Yeah.
And those things are, I feel like most things are sometimes a sign, but also it is scary going against the current of a group.
Yeah.
You know, it does raise your defences.
Yeah.
So kind of introspection seems to kind of work a bit.
Yeah.
But also isn't by any means infallible.
Okay, So what else might you do? Maybe I'll just pause a minute to see if I've done. So do people sort of understand the point that Matt's bringing up? So, and that I'm sort of drawing that being an individualist or a rebel and being a conformist actually are just the other side of the coin, because they're both, in both cases you need the group, you know, you need it to either get your security from, or you need it to kick against. They're both dependent on you, both in this highly dependent. Yeah, so Matt's saying, well, how do you tell the difference? So your state of mind might tell the difference, whether you're actually being a true individual. How else might you know the difference? Whether you're just rebelling or whether you're being a true individual. Yeah? Perhaps it depends on the group. So say more.
Maybe it's really difficult to tell, but it depends on the context, on the group, what exactly happened.
Yeah.
Maybe that's helpful. This is all really important information, I think, to make the judgment.
Okay, so the context might make a difference, yeah.
Right in the middle of it, it's really hard.
Yeah.
But maybe afterwards, step back and try to see, is it coming from love and generosity, or is it coming from grasping and greed?
Yeah.
Or through meditation, and then trying to learn to understand your feelings with hindsight at the beginning, but maybe if you practice it, then over time you get to know yourself and your feelings better.
So getting a bit more perspective. So hindsight might give you a bit more perspective. Any other ways of getting more perspective?
Asking friends.
Yeah.
That's quite a good one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So what, do you do that yourself then?
Yeah. I mean, it's not always easy, especially because in the sense the friend needs to be outside of the group in order to get
Yeah,
on it.
Yeah.
Then in virtue of that, they don't quite know the situation.
Yeah.
But it's
Yeah, so I think you need something. So I think it's really interesting, the points that, that Matt's drawing out, that we don't always know, because we don't always know ourselves, actually. And we love to think that we're individual, that we're free, that we're kind of, you know, nobody's got control over us. You know, we really like, you know, we want to feel that we believe we are a lot of the time, like... but actually we're much, much more influenced than we think we are. Much more, I would say, much more influenced than we think we are. We much more care about what other people think about us than we care to admit. Well, that's, you know, that's what I think myself. We much more care what people think about us. I was doing some painting at our house at the weekend in our community, and I was making a bit of a mess of one particular door I was painting, and I thought, I just can't bear anybody to know that that was the bit I did, you know. You know, so all the time, like, I don't really care that the door's got a few drips. I care that people know it was me who left the drips, you know. Do you know, so I do people recognise that, you know? Or it can't just be me, is it, you know? That we really, and I mean, that's a very small example, but we really... what people think of us, I think, matters more to us than we care to admit. And as long as it as long as that's in operation, that'll pull us into seeking approval. That'll pull us away from freedom. Yeah. Or else we'll just tend to rebel, you know. Or else we'll just kind of think, oh, I don't care what they think, you know. A door's a door, you know. You know. We'll sort of just get reactive about it. Yeah, but that's not, you know, that's not equanimity either, yeah? Yeah. Yes, Kate?
Could you say something about the line between influence and inspiration?
Uh-huh.
Or maybe you're going to elect.
Yeah. Yes. So that's an interesting distinguish, isn't it? Yeah. Because we are... on another hand, we want to be influenced positively, don't we? Well, a bit like, you know, all the people that didn't walk out when the Buddha said, I've got more to teach, want to be inspired and influenced, yeah? I think a simple rule of thumb is, like, how conscious is it? So I think the degree of consciousness we bring to it is a difference between, say, blind faith and blind, you know, sort of selling our soul almost. Between actually being receptive, like being receptive isn't being passive. So when we're conforming, we're being passive. When we're rebelling, we're being reactive. But when we're being receptive, we're actually being very active because we're being conscious. So I think the degree of consciousness we bring to it. Shall I say a little bit more about what Bantu says about the spiritual community? Because I think this will serve to... Oh, gosh, there's only 4 minutes left. My God, I better... How did that happen? So what he says was... So what he says is the purposes of a community of individuals or a spiritual community are utterly different from those of the group. So he says the spiritual community is a free association of individuals. So it's still, you know, it still can be a collection of people, but it's just a free association of individuals, yeah? And that is nothing but that. So he goes on, at sort of length of him. It's not anything else. He says you don't need a building, you don't need an authentic tradition. He says you don't even need a religion. What you need is individuals. That's the basic ingredient of a spiritual community. You need a collection of people who are relatively free from the group, who kind of know their minds, who are relatively integrated and aware and have got direction and purpose. To their lives, yeah. He says, when you've not got that, there'll be no spiritual community, whatever you call it, yeah. And to have that, for that to work, you're going to need to have a common ideal, and you're going to need to have a common way of practicing. Yeah, so you're going to. So that's, I mean, you can quickly see that that's why for the Sangha, which is spiritual community, you need to have the Buddha and the Dharma as well. Yeah. So when he's talking about the distinction, he's talking about, well, the group is simply trying to produce good group members. So it might be